You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this episode is Susan Fleming. Good morning, Susan. It's good to have you here.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
So Susan, the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation about the things you aspire to or the labels you wear or just where you've been?
I love this question because I think a lot about identity in the work that I do.
That's right.
It's an interesting question for me because I think that I wear many hats, but also have many identities. Mom would probably be the one that jumps to mind first. But I'm also, I think I'm a friend, I'm a business professional, I'm a professor, so a teacher, and a daughter. There's so many different things. I like to think of myself as a truth teller sometimes.
Right.
Sometimes people like that and sometimes they don't, but I do that. An advocate, an activist in some ways around women in leadership. But the identity piece comes in because I think in the work that I do in thinking about women in leadership and being a woman that I think increasingly has not... Let me put it this way. The other day, I had Thanksgiving with some good friends, and we were all named four things that we were thankful for. And one of them was that I'm so thankful that at the more advanced age of 47, that I'm, for the first time in my life, I spend most of my time going through the world being authentic. And that means I'm moving into different identities, but I'm not having to hide who I am.
Right. And you used an expression and then qualified it. You used I'm a truth teller, and sometimes people react to that. And you can almost tell a person's boundaries by whether they react to that or not. If you say a truth teller as opposed to the truth teller, you know that's a big piece. But people who are fairly strong and authentic in their own way of being have a great deal of space for each other's truths, and people who don't have this assumption that you're putting something over me or you're getting in my way or you're claiming something that's bigger than you could possibly ever claim. That's been my experience with people.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's an interesting thought. When I say a truth teller, it doesn't mean that my truth is right. And I think that it takes authenticity. It takes knowing oneself to be able to hear someone else's truth without being threatened by it.
To your point. And this is what I have to work with today. I may need to build a new boat or get a new car or get a new career, you know, tomorrow, but this is the one I'm working with today. And this is my truth because I know how it works.
Right.
But I may not know enough.
You know? Right.
And it doesn't take away anything, you know.
Yeah.
And you began with mom.
Yeah.
And that's the familial, and that doesn't, I mean, that fits my understanding of human beings, because as persons, we're in relation to those we're closest to.
Yeah, and I said mom, and I said friend, and friend would include my sister, who I'm really close with, but mom, it's just such a critically important identity, and one that, you know, I didn't particularly aspire to when I was younger. And I think that I have a number of friends who chose not to have children or couldn't have children, and they live wonderful lives, and I could have.
That could have been your life.
I'm not someone that believes that had I not had children, I would have had a terrible life, but I love that identity. And I just got a new puppy, so I'm mom to a new 11-week-old puppy. And boy, is that, it's like having a toddler in the house again, but so much fun. And being a mom has made me so much better person, or aspiring to be a better person. It's made me more authentic because kids see through everything, especially my son. It's just the two of us, and we spend a lot of time together, and I can't put anything past him. And I like that. So I'm really authentic with him. Again, he doesn't always love that, but
right. And he has to learn how to reciprocate. And that's his challenge, to grow up in an environment where you can be out there. And to realize that not everywhere in the world values that, but there may be some place, and probably the truer place does.
And the best moments between us are when I can literally feel it. I can hear it and feel it in these moments of when he's truly open and being himself. Mm-hmm. And that's connection to me. And usually it's because I'm creating that space. So if we both have that space, that's when you really connect with people. And I find that true in all my relationships, but my son has pushed me in that direction to be better at it.
Right. Right. And great topics to take up more later, especially how we create that space for each other and how we learn how to do that. And that's a workplace issue too, but I'm sure we will get to many of these things. You brought some music with you.
I did.
And you want to open with the Let It Go. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of my personal theme song, and it goes along with the idea of being authentic, because I grew up feeling, I think I grew up in a household where love and being good and being perfect were tied together for me. And so it's been a lifelong journey to accept that I'm so far from perfect, but also can be lovable. And that song is about, you know, I'm going to be who I am in the world. And that is just a decision I've made. So it's my theme song.
Here we go.
The snow glows white on the mountain tonight, not a footprint to be seen. A kingdom of isolation, and it looks like I'm the queen. The wind is howling like this swirling storm inside. Couldn't keep it in, heaven knows I tried. Don't let them in, don't let them see. Be the good girl you always have to be. Conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. Well, now they know. Let it go, let it go. Can't hold you back anymore. Let it go, let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care what they're going to say. Let the storm rage on. The cold never bothered me anyway. It's funny how some distance makes everything seem small. And the fears that once controlled me can't get to me at all. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Susan Fleming. So, Susan, what I'd like to go to next is this question. What are some of the experiences, given the life that you value now, and you're talking about authenticity and also about, you know, the willingness to take on a puppy that's like a toddler, but the life that you value now, what were some of the experiences you had to go through to realize this is where the value is?
Gosh, that's kind of a hard question. I've had a lot of interesting experiences in the past. So people...
But how did they come to add up to something that you...
Yeah, so I think, you know, childhood always has a big influence on you. And I grew up in a family where there were three girls. I was the youngest. I joke that I was raised as the boy.
they insisted
they just gave up and went, okay, we'll just make her the boy. But all of us
my
were...
parents had four girls, and then they kept on and had four boys.
So right. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Your parents are energetic. I'm impressed. So I was really kind of raised thinking that I could do whatever I wanted. Uh-huh. And that was also interesting. It was an interesting dichotomy because my parents also were in a more traditional marriage. My dad was dominant. My mom was a homemaker. Mm-hmm. So there was sort of the personal relationship side, but also my dad in particular, who's the power player.
Right.
He pushed us to think we could do whatever we wanted. And so I ended up
all
going to
of
Wall
you
Street.
Or even more than you.
I think all three of us, but I was the youngest and maybe the most personality type like him, more of a strong personality. And I do think a little bit raised as the boy. I don't know. Yeah. I got away with more because I was younger.
And parent, well, that and the younger child often does.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's just the way it works.
The birth order mattered in our family, for sure.
But you also, this also stands in an interesting contrast with the idea that, that love and value was kind of, more fixed or perfect.
I mean, achievement was a huge way. And I was uber achiever. I mean, I was valedictorian.
As long as you achieved.
Correct. And and whether that, I mean, that was my perception. I mean, I think that both my parents, I mean, my mother, I would think less fell into that. That was more my dad, that that dynamic of thinking perfection and love were tied. But, you know, was that actually true? No, but that was the perception. And so it really drove me throughout my life to feel the need to achieve, and fear was a big driver. Fear of failure was a big driver throughout. And so I ended up going to Wall Street and worked in mergers and acquisitions, and then was in private
equity.
Not a
heavily woman-dominated field, right?
Yeah, right. There were like, I mean, and then I went into private equity, and I was the only female investment professional in my firm for the 9 years I was there, except we did hire one associate who I'm still quite good friends with. And I made partner when I was 31 and, you know, really achieved and was hard driving, very much was one of the guys. And yet my dad was a college professor. I'm from Blacksburg, Virginia. It's like Ithaca, only Southern, a little bit.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm raging liberal. You know, I would go home at Thanksgiving and I would be like the representative of corporate America. But then I'd go back home and back to New York City and I would be the, you know, the socialist. And I was like, wait, I can't win here. But I ultimately wanted to do something else. And I think when you asked how I got here, today, I'm a professor at the hotel school, and I teach women in leadership and entrepreneurship, and I speak about women in leadership, and it's a real passion of mine. Mm-hmm. I did a PhD after I left Wall Street. I did a PhD at Johnson studying bias against women in business. And my whole life, that childhood growing up of trying to understand how I could be, or a woman can be, a powerful force of nature, but also be feminine, and sort of mixing those two roles has been something I've struggled with and trying to figure out my whole life. Then I went to Wall Street, and again, it's that same dynamic of, well, if you're too feminine, you're not going to succeed, but if you're, and so you be tough and masculine, but then you're not perceived as appropriately feminine enough.
Right.
And so that we call that the double bind. And it's something we don't call it, the world of people that study genders call it the double bind.
Right.
And so I think, you know, coming up and ultimately deciding to study this has been as much of a personal journey as it is an intellectual journey. And it's why I'm so passionate about the topic, and it's utterly flows through everything in my life, the way I raise my son, the way I interact with my friends, my students. I teach entrepreneurship, but I'm always talking about diversity and the need to allow people to be who they are, because gender bias doesn't just affect women. It's society forcing people into boxes that aren't comfortable, and so that authenticity you know, it's so counter to authenticity to me. And that really bugs me now. And so I think, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but that journey for me around women and bias has been also coming to terms with who I am and accepting what I am, and that I can be strong and I can be feminine and I can be a voice and I can be all these identities, and that's all okay.
Right.
And I don't have to be perfect.
Yes. And so I just tell a little story here. The people that I grew up among, because it was a rural area where the population was leaving because there just were no jobs, and mechanization and capitalization were just so intense that they were pushing people out. But the historic people there, the mature people that I knew, were born in the 1880s and 90s and early 1900s. And, you know, there was no contradiction between being feminine and strong. You know, there was no contradiction between being male and being sensitive. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you weren't both, you in some sense were not mature. And people would be judged for their deficits, in the sense if they couldn't kind of figure out how to dance the many roles they would have to play. Because in a rural life, you have to play many roles, and there aren't others to take them up for you. And people would step in to help. The judgment wasn't so strong. It didn't have so much to be about perfectionist, but just being engaged and responsive.
So I've
always, when I came east to go to college, I experienced the gender bias stuff as just like a whiplash, because I didn't have that same kind of highly stereotyped gender roles. We had it on mass media, but we didn't have it so much in the cultural history.
That's interesting. Now, was it a farm? It was a farming community?
Yeah, it was a very small farming
community. See, I think that makes a huge difference. Yeah. So, you know, money is power and economic contribution is power. Yeah. And I think that it's easier to push those gender biases, or it's convenient to push those gender biases in environments where women don't have that same economic power.
That's right.
And you know, if you look at what happened during World War II, when women, with Rosie the Riveter, and women came into the workforce, then the men came home and the government and society wanted to get the women back in the boxes. And that's where you had the 50s, where those strong, uber feminized, women are weak, gender biases got really reinforced.
Right.
And it's been, you know, I'm not sure it's ever changed.
No. I know. And so it is a reality, but it creates the backdrop. But you talked about being achievement oriented, but also being fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And where did that fit into the picture? Where did the fear? I mean, as parents, we set up the things that our kids live toward, which we do it unwittingly, but we kind of help create a context in which they will frame their struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And fear was part of mine, but it was a fear of, if I don't get out of here, I'm done, because it was becoming a rural ghetto where I was from. And so the fear was doing something that would be even just mildly inappropriate or mildly acting out as a teenager, but I didn't have the luxury of messing up.
Right.
Because any mess up would have threatened my scholarship and getting out.
Yeah.
But where did the fear come from?
Not being loved. Like, if you weren't good enough, if you didn't do well, then you were in trouble. And then that called into question your value as a person.
Wow.
I mean, and I don't mean to say, you know, my parents were amazing in so many ways. So, you know, I want to qualify very clearly what I perceived versus what they intended.
Right. Right.
And, but that was, and, you know, honestly, I achieved a lot, and that has created just tremendous flexibility for me in my life.
Sure.
You know, it is such a privilege in so many ways to be able to pick and choose what I do in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And that's because I got pushed and because I was that achievement oriented. And so I'm not sorry for it, but it has been taken a lot of introspection, which again, my family, you didn't do introspection. You didn't examine things. You just kind of kept going. And one of the things you asked is like, what brought me to this place? Well, I went through a tough divorce, and that caused me to become much more introspective and think a lot harder about who I am.
Right.
And be more accepting of myself. And I'm glad for that too.
Right. 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 And I think when a lot of what happened coming from the late 19th, early 20th century was an idea that the nuclear family was an ideal thing. And that never was true historically in any human society. I mean, we've kind of in the West, Europe and the US, we've kind of in Canada, we've kind of made that, but it really has never been true. And if you need to learn the difference between approval and acceptance, if you have a wide community around you that can accept you, sometimes it can make up for issues around your parents. But if your parents' notions of success are approving that, oh, you did that really well, and you don't experience the really well, and that's a surrogate for affection, which I know in some in some middle-class families,
yeah,
people confuse approval and acceptance.
Yeah.
And what's meant is acceptance, but they're not getting it.
Right. No, and again, that's why I don't want to sound judgmental in my family. That is exactly right. And, you know, what's interesting is, because I just kept achieving, mm-hmm, I never got to really test so hard with them whether or not acceptance would come without approval. Right. Like, I tended to have both.
So was your divorce your first big failure?
Because
one of the things is that if people don't have a major failure by the age of 30 or 35, many of them will not recover from it. It's a very hard thing and this is one of the things sociologically. So you had a failure later and you've recovered from it.
Yeah. Although I got married at 34 and, you know, so
you started
30s. Yeah. And I certainly had other smaller failures, many of them along the way. Yeah. But that was a big one.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a big one.
So what did you learn about yourself that you now... You talk about the process of introspection, but what did you learn of value about holding yourself in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, I think I learned that... I always knew I wasn't perfect. I'm my own worst critic, like overly critical. And I've learned...
And you finally got the message.
Right. I mean, I always knew I wasn't, but I really... really know that now. I know it much more than I used to.
And now you can laugh at it.
And now I laugh at it. I declare it, you know, in when I teach. And one of the big things around teaching, whatever you're teaching, but particularly if you're teaching around things around bias and whatnot, you have to create a safe space for other people to be able to engage. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that I create a safe space is I point out my flaws. And people are so much more forgiving if you know that you have an insecurity or you know that you have a habit. Now, that does not mean that you shouldn't keep trying to work on those habits that are not great. I mean, I'm a work in progress and I want to keep improving and changing and growing. But I've also accepted that some of them I may never fully succeed at. And, you know, that's okay because I'm a package. Right. I have a lot of other good, really great qualities that come to play. And they aren't fatally wiped out by the fact that I interrupt and I talk too much and sometimes I'm a little too direct, you know, and those things.
Yeah. And what changes, though, and this is interesting that you raise it in the context of teaching or just modeling as a parent. If you learn that it's got to be the real challenge that you're not doing so well on that particular day or that particular year or that particular decade, and eventually you realize that some of these things are just not going to get better.
Right.
And people are going to need to do for you what you can't do for yourself because and you're going to do the same for them. And when you can model that and it's clearly grounded in reality of the moment, then that allows people to be in the moment.
Right.
With you. It's just like when people try to do that and they're talking about things that aren't real for them now, and I've seen some teachers try to do that, or some people in, you know, just informal relationships. It needs to be what's in the moment, now.
I've also learned, I think, by being cognizant of and owning your own flaws, I've also learned to say sorry more. I've learned to I'm more accepting of others. Because I'm more accepting of myself.
Yeah.
And
you can apologize to yourself, I would imagine, from what you just said.
Oh, yeah. You know, I can. Again, I'm still my own worst critic, but much more. And you know, it's some days I have to remind myself really heavily to embrace, nope, you're not perfect and it's okay. And
it's,
you know,
not changing anytime soon.
Exactly. Exactly.
So let's take a musical break. What should we play next?
Oh gosh. I don't know. Stuck in a Moment is a funny one because the lyrics itself don't necessarily completely fit, but it's a song that I've made major life decisions, and I think it's less about the song, but it was like I was in the right moment and I heard that, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh, you got to have some courage here and get out of this place you're in.
Right.
And whether it's ending a relationship or making a career move, that it resonates with me. And so now when I'm really noodling and I'm not sure if I should make a change, sometimes I'll just go listen to that because it gives me a kick in the butt to do something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, here we go.
I'm not afraid of anything in this world. There's nothing you can throw at me that I haven't already heard. I'm just trying to find a decent melody, a song that I can sing in my own company. I never thought you were a fool, but darling, look at you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Susan Fleming. So, Susan, how did you, you know, I mean, you kind of, you ascended the corporate, in the corporate world fairly quickly. I mean, at 31 as a partner, I mean, now maybe that sounds a little young, but not, maybe that's typical. But then you left. How did you, why did you migrate to academia?
So I'm asked that a lot. And first, I should clarify, I didn't leave private equity investing to become a professor. I left. Mm-hmm. And then later, really largely because I was in Ithaca And my father had been a college professor in education, no less. He was a professor of education. Teaching was of interest to me, and so that's how I got into it. But to fill that in a little bit, so I made partner at 31. That was in 2001. And then I stayed on for two more years at our private equity fund. And there's a natural break point where you've invested all of the money in that particular fund, because you go out and raise money, and we needed to go out and raise more money. And it would have been at that point another 8 or 9 year commitment. Mm-hmm. And truthfully, we'd gone through the internet bubble where that we were investing in internet companies and the market crash. This was in the 2000, 2001, yeah. Which made it not that much fun. The politics in our firm, and I have very low tolerance for any sort of politics, right, had become more heated. And I also think that in retrospect, I didn't think about this at the time, but I think I had accomplished what I went to Wall Street for. Now, I went to Wall Street not even really knowing what it was. The only reason I went into investment banking is because it was the most competitive, hard to get job that I knew about.
And you were going
to
take the challenge.
Yeah, it really was. And then that's how I got recruited into private equity. I got headhunted and I was like, oh, what's this? This sounds cool. And so I did it. You know, I tell my students all the time they should think about their career and be strategic, and I didn't do any of that. So I was ready.
You followed your nose.
Yeah, I followed my nose, and I was good at it, and I worked really hard, and I ended up connecting with some really good people that supported me, and that was really important. But I, in retrospect, think that I wanted to prove that I could play with the boys. And once I'd made partner, I've never been driven by money. And so if I'd stayed, it would have been really purely just to make more money. Right. And I had saved. I was raised in a thrifty household, and you know, I saved every bonus, every bit of profit share in right. the fund. And so I had a lot of flexibility, and I thought, well, I don't want to keep doing this for 8 or 9 more years. So I quit. I basically retired from private equity.
And how old were you when you retired?
I was 33. I wasn't retiring because I obviously was going to do something else. But it is an unusual thing. Yeah, it's an unusual thing to walk away. Now, within 6 months, I broke up with my boyfriend of 5.5 years after listening to Stuck in a Moment, and then decided to quit my job. And they weren't so related because I'd been thinking about it for a while, right. Decided to leave. And right around the time that I left my firm, Cap Z, I started dating someone that was living up here in Ithaca, who later became my husband and the father of my son, and then my ex-husband. And so he was doing his PhD here. And so after about 6 months, there was no need for me to be living in Manhattan because I wasn't working. I was thinking about, I wanted to do some teaching and be a lecturer possibly. At the time, I also thought about starting a venture fund that invested in social enterprises, so or maybe going overseas and doing like development work, which I still want to do, go work in the Peace Corps or something. But because I was in Ithaca, I came up here, and that limited the kinds of things that I could do. And so I started considering the academic path a lot more seriously. And fortunately hooked up with a great woman named Melissa Thomas Hunt, who used to be a professor at the Johnson School. And she let me try out doing research. So I applied to the PhD program here, as well as a few other places. I almost went to Northwestern, actually. And my ex-husband was willing to move. But I decided to stay at Cornell, and I did my PhD here at Johnson. And then right when I finished my PhD and I would have been going on the job market, my husband and I split up, and we had an almost 2-year-old. And so that meant that I believe strongly in sharing custody and having two parents. And so I didn't go on the job market, and I ended up kind of scrapping around doing teaching at Johnson for a while. And then an opportunity at the hotel school opened up for me to teach entrepreneurship. And so I started doing that, and I taught at both schools for a while. And now I'm actually at the hotel school. I'm 75% of the time, because I still, all this time, I didn't leave the corporate world. I'm still in the corporate world. I sit on the board of public companies. I'm an active angel investor. So I very much think of myself as a businesswoman more than probably an academic per se.
Sure.
And I'm a senior lecturer. So a teacher, yes. I do research, but I'm a teacher and a business person probably first, and a practitioner. Mm-hmm, but I mm-hmm. do strongly believe in the academic establishment and the importance of theory and as well. And mm-hmm. being able to blend those for me is a strength in the business world, but also in the classroom.
Sure.
Sorry, that was long, but it gives you a little context because it's a little strange.
Well, no, but it also kind of, it grew organically.
Yeah.
And maybe that's worth rethinking. You know, in the old days of rational planning and planned economy, idealism stuff, people could make some judgments. This is how you should do things. But it may be more important that we're more skilled at kind of being people and responding to the opportunity in the moment and looking ahead and looking behind simultaneously rather than having a kind of a roadmap.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I never had a roadmap and it did come organically. But now, one of the things that I've recently done with the help of a good friend is sort of sit down and look at least for the next year, what are mm-hmm. the 10 things I want to work on,
sure.
whether it's professionally, personally, all of those. And part of that does include being a little bit more strategic about the portfolio of activities that I mm-hmm. do. And that's partly because there's a lot of opportunities out there. So it's more, you know, I sit on the board of PRI, I'm on the board of the TC3 Foundation Investment Committee. You know, I want to continue to do that mm-hmm. kind of work, but I also like the corporate board work. And I've been speaking a lot more on women in leadership in the corporate world and also locally. And then I'm a professor and I'm a mom. And so there's not enough hours in the day. So trying to think strategically about how you put that together in a way that's somewhat coherent. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, I want to make sure that everything that I do, that I get something back. And that doesn't need to be financial. It can be. Mm-hmm. It could be gratification. It could be, you know, feeling the need to do something good for others. But I want to make sure that each thing I do kind of helps pull together that picture.
Right.
For
right.
me.
And you've listed disparate kinds of roles, because there are some that are highly segmented, which are institutionalized and socialized, and they are discrete packages.
Yep.
You could be almost an interchangeable person, and you would fill them out in specific ways because of who you are, but you could be a person, many different people could fill those roles.
Yeah.
But you are the mom to your son. That is a personal role that is not in any sense institutionalized in a way that somebody could step into it only without, you know, only if you were, you know, something happened to you, and it wouldn't be the same.
Right.
So we tend to, when we try to balance these equations of how do we build a life that looks good, and I'm thinking is making decisions over the next year is not like trying to make decisions 10 years from now or right. 20 years. And people right. who do planning oftentimes go too far out.
Yeah.
We need to think 50 and 100 years out in terms of what our impact could be, but any specific steps are only in maybe 6 months, a year, 3 to 5 year time zones, because then it becomes too, the intervening opportunities become too complex.
And all of my, even as I've just now started to be a bit more strategic, I mean, to be honest, all of it is geared around the first core is how long my son will be in school
right.
and with me. And that's kind of first and foremost. Now, and I tell him all the time, you are my first, he's my first priority, my second priority, my third priority. Yeah. But not necessarily in every single moment of every single day.
Yes.
And he's been amazing. He's 10, and he's been really amazing in that there have been times when to travel to a corporate board, I've had to change his schedule around, which isn't always mm-hmm. convenient for him, or I haven't missed anything major yet, but, you know, major for him right. in terms right. of a concert, whatever. But those things happen. But I've sat down with him and said, listen, here's why I do this. Here's why I care about it. It also earns extra money and things like that. But
right.
mostly it's, for me, being on corporate boards, I enjoy the work intellectually. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the people. It's an identity that's important to me. But it's also, there's there's not enough women on corporate boards. And so me simply being in the room, if I have the opportunity to be in the room, I damn well should be in the room.
Right, right.
And he gets that. And he has been so supportive where I've said, listen, when I was on two boards for most of the time in while I've been here, I've been on two. And one, we just sold the company back in March, and I'm looking to join another one. But I've had a lot of conversations with him about that. You know, hey, if I join another one, there's going to be, you know, I'll be a bit busier on this. And he's like, nah, you should do it, Mom. You love it. And, you know, it's important to you. And right. that gives me such gratification as a mom to see him be, you know, kids are self-centered and he can step out of that also.
Right. But also kids may be self-centered, but they desperately want to contribute to the whole.
Yeah. And he does.
And the way an institution works versus the way a community works is in the community, you have to give account for your whole life to the people whom your whole life impacts. And so that's oftentimes a partner or a child or a parent, depending upon your closeness, or a dear friend. And the kind of accountability that works in a community relationship is very different than the accountability that works in an institutional relationship where you're segmented and high and it's more hierarchically organized. You've seemed to have found a way to kind of hold that clearly and engage him in that way clearly so that he can see these other kinds of decisions that are in a different framework that you need to make.
Well,
and helps him to, and we don't teach our children that kind of clarity. I mean, I had that with my daughter from the opposite perspective. Most of my life is community oriented and not specifically institution oriented. And so, but she got to see that kind of balancing because we talked our way through it. And now she manages healthcare for 20,000 people and some of the poorest, most ill people in Nassau, Suffolk, and the eight counties of the Hudson Valley. But that's because it's just part of how she's learned to build a life.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons. It's not just my doing. I mean, I think, but a couple things that were important around that particular topic is that one of the board, the company just sold, is in Bermuda, and we would, my mom would come, and I would bring Carter with me down to the meetings once or twice a year, and he got to meet everybody on the board. He knows what I do and he's seen it. He's also, you know, now I've brought him once to a talk that I gave. And, you know, it's, I have a class potluck for my students at the end of every semester. So he's very integrated. He knows my people. He sees me professionally as well as sees me as a mom. And I bounce back and forth. And, you know, there's tremendous value in that because they see me, the people, the businessmen, the students, they see me also as a mom. So they get to know me in a more authentic way. Which means, by the way, if something comes up and there's a choice that needs to be made, I can say, look, I have my son right now and this is, I can make this work, but I can't make this work. And they cut you, they work with you more.
Well, right. And you started to say they cut you slack.
Yeah, I was going to say
you cut you slack. That's the objective reality.
It's not really slack because I always get the job done. I do it in a more flexible way sometimes.
And you do it without the perfectionism.
Yeah.
You know, and so if they're cutting you slack, then you're being imperfect and you're having to kind of inch your way up in that rhetoric. What we don't do for our kids is model how to live in both of these worlds that have very different rules. The kind of the open, your life is with discretion and a relatively open book of things for your son.
In Ithaca. Yeah.
And his is for you too. Mm-hmm. And someday he will have that relationship with somebody else and others. And he probably does to some extent with his father and other people.
Oh, yeah.
But we don't model how we navigate relationships that have fundamentally different operating systems. Mm-hmm. And yet you seem to have kind of found this way. And
I tried to.
And the authentic piece was when you, because authenticity means different things in different settings.
Yeah.
It forces you to develop a level of flexibility that you might not otherwise.
Yeah, and being authentic doesn't mean that you don't have to adapt. I mean, when I'm sitting
it
at a
means
corporate
being adaptive.
Right. If I'm sitting in a corporate board meeting where I'm one of 14 people on the board, I'm the only woman and I'm the youngest by maybe 20 years. I have to behave differently to be taken seriously. both as a woman, both as a younger person, and also just as a corporate executive, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you have to behave differently than you do in other contexts, and that's okay. And so you have to be smart about that. At the same time, I'm grateful that I don't feel the need, or I haven't had to completely hide my identity as a mom, mm-hmm. right? Partly by necessity that I brought him with me, but two, these guys also, they all have grandkids now, and it's very interesting. I don't know if they'd be as forgiving when they were younger, but now they're older and they see their daughters that have kids and they see what they deal with, and that really helps. It really helps.
The transparency helps us be real.
Yeah.
Across the board.
Yeah.
So how has this awareness of authenticity and the many accommodations, as well as, which are all authentic, the many ways of being in different settings, how has that affected the way in which you deal with bias?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think one thing that is important, and I'm not sure this is totally responsive to your question, but when I finished my PhD in 2009, which was not that long ago, but I've evolved in the way that I think about bias and the way that I teach and speak about it, in that I used to be much more focused on how women got a raw deal. And I think that over time, being more that authenticity or being more open and more accepting, it's made me be much more mindful of how bias operates to hurt everybody. Hmm. So I have a bigger tent around it.
Okay.
And that's actually been incredibly powerful, because you can then connect with everybody. Everybody mm-hmm. has some identity that's been threatened, or that is, and sometimes you have to really jump through hoops to find, like, you know, is there any identity that you're not in a privileged state? Because there are some people that mostly fall in they're rich, white men, you know, mm-hmm. Christian, you know, et cetera. But you can find them, and they're there, and it allows you to connect more. So again, I work really hard to find those connections, because if you can get people to step in and take the perspective of being the victim, they get it. Mm-hmm. And then they're more likely to want to make change.
Right. So, so I'm also trying to think about how that change happens. Is the change to fix it, or is the change to each time engage it with greater fairness?
Well, I don't know. When you say fix it, I'd like people to be less biased. I want people right. to be more aware. And one way that, again, being accepting myself, is I own one of the best ways to get somebody else to be willing to engage in their own bias mm-hmm. is to share with them all the times that I've done it.
Right.
And then, but that doesn't mean that that you're giving permission. It's saying, we all have bias on certain things, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and most of us have bias. Pretty much everyone has gender bias, race, but I mean, we have much of it. But you have to start policing yourself and being aware of it. And so to me, that's how you fix it. You fix it in that you are more open to individualizing people, to being mindful of mm-hmm. how you are putting that person in a box and making assumptions about them
right.
that you wouldn't want to be made about you based on sure. something about yourself.
And I guess I'm looking for something that's possibly even a little bit different than what you responded to, because I understand what you responded to communicates clearly and well. But the assumption I'm starting from is that since we perceive everything with a positive or negative spin, even before we're aware we've perceived it, mm-hmm. our biases will never stop operating.
Right.
So we're never going to resolve it. We might get better or quicker.
Correct.
Than we might hear. But what the issue is being open to addressing it.
Yeah.
And so that quality of openness is what we're cultivating rather than an outcome. The outcomes will fall into place.
Totally agree.
If we get the attitude or the openness in place.
Yeah. I mean, I really believe that you have to come at these issues, and it is hard. You have to stop coming at these issues from a place of judgment, and you need to come at them from a place of learning and acceptance.
And curiosity.
And it's a learning environment. And so, you know, being willing to have the courage to ask you know, I gave this example the other day in class. On Tuesday, I'm teaching a new case on a woman who is the COO of a family-run business in the United Arab Emirates. She's a Muslim woman. And I'm teaching, and I said to the class in advance, I said, we're doing this case. I've never done it before. I am a white American woman, and so I'm a little nervous about teaching a case that we're going to talk about other cultures. And I've done cases on Indra Nui, but that's a little more familiar. I've at least been to India and, you know, have some exposure. But, you know, that getting into that issue of Muslim identity and culture and religion, it's a little scary, but I'm going to do it because I want to learn about it. And I said to the class, I said, you know, I know there's one woman who wears a hijab in the class, so I happen to know she certainly could add to the conversation. But I was said, if there's anyone in this class that can really add to this, please step up, call me out if I say something that isn't right. Let's learn about this together. And again, creating that learning orientation, it created a great conversation with many of the different students who are of color, and they started jumping in and talking about, oh yeah, you know, because I asked, is it better to, when you're interacting with somebody, is it okay if they ask you about why do you wear a headscarf, or tell me about your culture, or tell me about this? And they said, yeah, we'd rather that you ask than to just go around having assumptions about us. And so I, you know, I don't know if that answers, but this idea of being, but if you ask in a way that's interested in learning,
right,
then you get somewhere.
Right. And one of the things that I've done through Shared Journeys is have people use these three questions. How does your religion or your core values make a difference in your life?
Right.
What about that religion or those core values do you, ways of living, are hardest for you to live up to? Mm-hmm. And what do people need to know about you in order to be most respectful of you?
Yeah.
And if people are given the chance to explain what it is that they're living for and toward, what it is that they find difficult and how you can be respectful, they're happy to tell you.
Yeah. And if you're asking from a place of wanting to learn.
Wanting to hear.
And hear. And so the thing that I most, my class is only 7 weeks long, but I tell them at the beginning and I'll tell them at the end, the single one thing that I want them to get out of this class is to walk out questioning their assumptions. Go through the world questioning your assumptions more than you do now. Mm-hmm. And it could be about gender, that would be great, but whatever. Right. You know, question your assumptions about other people, about your own role in society, about what you can accomplish, about what others can accomplish, instead of putting labels on them.
Right. And it works both ways. It's a question, you know, what are other people's assumptions and how do they shape their, I mean, it's a universal question. I want to switch gears here a little bit. What do you do to take care of yourself? And this is a question I end every show with, physically, emotionally, intellectually, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, regularly. What do you do and how do you know you need to do it?
So exercise is huge. I've been a runner my whole life. I've done 9 marathons, I think. And I don't do marathons anymore because as I've gotten older, it's gotten harder. But I bike, I run, I walk, whatever. I need to be active. It helps me. I'm super high energy. It relieves stress. So that's huge for me. You can do whatever test you want, and I read as an extrovert. Mm-hmm. But over time, I've realized I need time by myself and much more than I used to. And so if I, because I operate at a high level of intensity, my son's intense and I operate that way, and teaching and the kind of things I cover intense, I need to withdraw and be alone or just have time to myself. So those are the sort of day-to-day things that I think are most important. I now try to get 8 hours of sleep, which I didn't for years and years. I think I was just tired for like 15 years when I first had Carter and when I worked on Wall Street. And then on the long-term picture, the way I kind of reset, or I always have tried to, is to get perspective, especially when I worked on Wall Street, which is, listen, there's a lot of amazing people, but it's such a money culture and it's so intense that I would go to third world countries and I would go trekking or I would go do volunteer work. This was actually in Alaska. I did Habitat for Humanity, India, Peru. getting that reset of perspective is so important. So in whether it's in day-to-day life, week-to-week, or year-to-year, if I feel too out of whack and I'm feeling sorry for myself, I need to just go and engage with somebody that has less and that may have more in other ways, but in terms of economically or is really dealing with something challenging, because it puts in perspective right, that pretty much what I deal with is never a big deal.
And it needs to be a challenge that makes your jaw drop.
Yeah, jaw-dropping challenge. Yeah. And increasingly, you know, I want to expose my son to that idea too. So whether it's doing volunteer work or something, but I think getting that perspective is hugely important. I don't need it as much now because I think I do it more day-to-day. But when I was in New York, I needed to go on the big trip to step out.
Right, right, right. I mean, and if you build that, I mean, part of my personal work is to build a life that has people of all stations in it 7 days a week.
Yep.
And so that I don't need necessarily to take a vacation in that sense or
yeah.
whatever. But one of my children's jokes that I've been living my retirement since I, you know, went to college, because I basically try to cobble together the kind of life a person would like to live. If financially it's a little interesting at times, but, what I'm trying to say here is there's a balance. And and you realize, when did you realize that there is something of an introvert in you? I mean, the people who do the Myers-Briggs stuff say over time you tend to realize that there are benefits to the other side of these these polar things. And you learn how to either compensate or to dip into them.
Yeah. When did I realize? Oh, gosh, in the last 7, 8 years? I don't know. Two of the Myers-Briggs, I'm right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And extrovert, I was always way out on the edge, but I've definitely come in some. Mm-hmm. And I think since having Carter being older, he's with me half the time. He's with his dad half the time. When he's with his dad, I work more hours. I push everything out. I'm running around. When he's with me, you know, when he's with me, I pick him up from school and we are together. Like, and so we spend all our time together pretty much. I mean, we'll do stuff with other people as well. But so there's an intensity to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that in particular has made me realize that I need that introverted time, because I get worn out and I'm not my best self. And I always want to try and be my best self with him in particular. Right. If I don't get enough sleep or I don't get that away time a little bit.
Right. But when you say when you're with him, given the conversation you described earlier, you are the professional and the mom who's with him. The whole you is with him.
Yeah.
You're talking through. I mean, that's often not what parents say when they mean they're with their kids, because they're not wholly with them, because they're with them as kids, as opposed to bringing the two lives together. This is a huge issue in this culture.
Yeah.
Where we treat children as children and don't expect them to be introduced to the ways or the things that older people are mulling in to the degree that they can appreciate and become part of the decision process.
Yeah, and I'm doing that. And to give credit to his dad and his stepmom, they do that. And his school, he goes to Elizabeth Anklein Montessori, and they're very...
Montessori is extraordinarily...
They do that. And people would say, like, he's like a little adult in some ways. And he is very adaptable, very able to move through different worlds.
And skillful in that way.
Yeah.
But not seasoned, which is what a child is.
Yeah.
And that's...
He doesn't always get it right, but he's, but, you know, as he says, he's divorced, you know, and he's been divorced since he was 2. And, you know, there's really awful things about that, but there's also good things in that he is exposed to different family systems, different ways of parenting, different ways of being, different places, more opportunities. And he's had to learn to be adaptable to different contexts, which is an important skill.
Yeah.
And some people never learn it, but he learned it at a young age.
Right. And when you have people who are looking after you kindly, who do not bring you into their conflicts so much, then that's a wonderful skill coming out of a divorce often.
Yeah.
Susan, it's been wonderful to get to know you. What should we close the show with? What music?
You know, I'm going to say, Soldier. And the reason I say that is one thing that we haven't talked about. That song is actually a song that is my song with my son. And it's basically like, I will be there for you. So even though I have all these identities, when it comes down to it, I will always be his soldier. Yep. But that's also true for my friends. My friends... are up here, especially, they're like my world, my girlfriends, but I have men friends too, but especially my girlfriends, they're like the family that I would have chosen. Mm-hmm. And so for me, an incredibly important identity is to be that good person that's there for them when they need me. Right. And so that kind of is a shout out to them and right. my son.
Whole people, even in times of brokenness.
Yeah.
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 Here we go. Da-da-da.
Through it nice and slow when the world's spinning out of control. Afraid of what they might lose, might get scraped or they might get bruised. You could beg them what's the use? That's why it's called a moment of truth. Yeah, I'll get it if you need it. I'll search if you don't see. If you can't see it, you're thirsty.